This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's top negotiator says lasting commitment of all the parties to the 2015 deal will speed up achievement of an agreement on its revival. Ukraine's president says his country's forces have made major advances against Russian forces, capturing dozens of villages in the south and the east. And the World Bank says Ukraine's economy will shrink by 35% this year due to numerous crises resulting from the ongoing war in the country. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran says sustainable commitments of all parties to the 2015 deal will make rapid achievement of an agreement on the revival of the accord possible. The remark was made by Iran's top negotiator to the negotiations held to revive the deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Ali Bagheri-Kani added that abidance by all parties by their commitments will guarantee that an agreement on reviving the deal will last. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump quit the JCPOA in May 2018 and reinstated unilateral sanctions on Iran. Since last year, Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA have held several rounds of talks to revive the deal. Despite notable progress, the U.S.'s indecisiveness and procrastination caused multiple interruptions in the talks. Iran has dismissed Morocco's claim that Tehran is meddling in Yemen's internal affairs. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said Morocco should be concerned about threats to the region due to its normalization with Israel, instead of baselessly accusing Iran. He advised Morocco to work for ending the sufferings of the oppressed people of Yemen. He said Rabat should prepare the ground for determining the fate of Western Saharan people under the UN Charter. This after Morocco's foreign minister Nasser Bourita accused the Islamic Republic of spreading, quote, terrorism, division and dispute in the Arab world. Dozens of Moroccans have gathered outside the European Union office in Rabat to protest against what they call France's racist and humiliating treatment of their compatriots over visa applications. The demonstrators accused the EU states of limiting the number of visas and rejecting applicants despite meeting the relevant criteria. They said denying visas is discriminatory. They also criticized refusing to justify visa denials or refund processing fees. The Schengen visas issued to non-EU citizens allow the holder to travel freely among 26 EU countries. In 2021, France decided to halve the number of visas issued to Moroccans and Algerians. Paris cited reluctance by those countries to repatriate their citizens living secretly in France. The Canadian government has recently imposed fresh sanctions against dozens of Iranian individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. That's as Canada itself has checkered history of rights violations, including unlawful killings and crimes against Indigenous people. We discuss with our guests in the News Review program the reason behind Canada's latest move against Iran, with which it has no diplomatic relations.
Canada has imposed fresh sanctions on 34 Iranian individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. The sanctions list announced by the Canadian Foreign Minister includes 25 people and 9 entities, including English News Network, Press TV. Now, this a week after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau pledged to impose sanctions on the Iranian government. And this is not the first time that Canada has come up with such measures against Iran, with which it doesn't have any diplomatic ties. Ottawa in the past also blacklisted around 200 Iran entities and individuals. Now let's get some insight on this. So joining me will be Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator with Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network in Vancouver. Also with us will be Tawhid Asadi, academic and political analyst in Tehran. Good to have both of you. So Charlotte, I can give you a list of what Amnesty International has reported regarding rights violations in a country called Canada. It includes just highlights, indigenous people's rights, investigations on allegations of racist violence against, for example, Mi'kmaq people, and then we have children in those residential schools in the story, and the mass graves that you heard about, and then we got lots of them, like the right to water, health, and housing. This is what Amnesty International is saying. For First Nation communities especially, discrimination, refugees and migrants' rights, women's rights, and you name it. And a country with such a record of human rights is now blaming other countries for things maybe considered much less important.
What we're seeing is the Canadian state time and time again follows in line with the interests and demands of the United States and U.S. imperialism. And, you know, that alignment is based on controlling the resources and the future of the people of Iran and the people throughout the region. And so this is the same reason why we see the Canadian government over and over and over again backing war crimes and crimes against humanity in occupied Palestine to the hilt, and using this weapon of sanctions against countries and people around the world in an attempt to essentially prevent countries and peoples from exercising their right to independent development and a positive future for their people. I mean, this is, sanctions are a war crime. Sanctions are an imperialist attack. And when we're seeing what's happening now, where the Canadian government is adding television stations to this list of sanctioned entities, this is fundamentally an attempt to prevent anything but the official side of the story from Western governments from being heard to people around the world, including people here who really have no interest in continuing to perpetrate these policies of sanctions, war, and imperialism around the world, let alone the ongoing settler colonialism and genocide against indigenous people that continues to take place on this land.
Okay. Now, Tawhid, tell us about part of the sanctions also has been placed on Press TV, and this is what, for instance, Facebook and Google did also a while ago. So let's talk about that a little bit.
I think basically there are a couple of points regarding this new round of sanctions imposed by Canadian government against Iran, and what tops the list and actually grasps my attention could be analyzed and, let's say, summarized in three perspectives. First of all, we are observing kind of interventionist approach from the Canadian government pertaining to Iran, and part of these sanctions are really could be analyzed under this context of interventionism. And then the sixth point is that, as your other respected guest mentioned, we see that Canada is kind of blind obedient to U.S. foreign policy on the basis and on the very core of which we see this rancorous, hostile, obnoxious trajectory of, let's say, mindset and practice regarding Iran. And Canada, with no initiative, just follows the orders that are directed from Washington. And so this is quite shameful for a country that claims for subject matters like independence, like sovereignty, and etc.
Thank you so much for that. Charlotte Cates in Vancouver, Tawhid Asadi in Tehran.
Seven years ago, on October the 3rd, U.S. airstrikes destroyed the trauma hospital run by Doctors Without Borders in Afghanistan's city of Kunduz. 42 people were killed in the attack, including patients, caretakers, and hospital staff. Rahmatullah Baghwan reports from Kabul.
Back on October 3, 2015, this Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz was reduced to rubble after being hit by a U.S. deadly airstrike. 211 shells were fired in the strike, lasting almost 1 hour. The charity hospital later announced that 42 civilians, including staffers and patients, were killed, and dozens of others were wounded.
Throughout the NATO coalition presence in Afghanistan, there were a lot of blind air strikes and rights violations against Afghan civilians, especially by American air forces. The 2015 attack on Kunduz Charity Hospital was one of those atrocities and the biggest of its kind. As I remember, it was so deadly and devastating. Hospitals in war zones are protected under the 4th Geneva Convention, and attacks on them should be tried as a war crime.
After initially denying the building being targeted, the U.S. eventually claimed responsibility for the airstrikes, justifying that it had been a serious and tragic mistake.
Independently and impartially.
The MSF called it a breach of international humanitarian law and a war crime, demanding for an independent probe. But an independent investigation or trial has never been conducted against the U.S. forces' atrocities.
The MSF and rights bodies believe that the U.S. deadly air raid on Charity Hospital could be prosecuted as a war crime, but the international courts and bodies failed to conduct a trial because they are controlled by arrogant powers. They are funded by those countries and obey them. Besides, the U.S. has never agreed to turn any of their service members over to an outside judicial body. As a result, the case of the Kunduz attack was shot by Washington with a mere discipline of some American personnel, and no one was criminally charged.
Throughout the two-decade U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, there had been more than 13,000 airstrikes conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed more than 4,000 people, including women and children. The U.S. airstrike on the Charity Hospital in Kunduz is one of the many instances of American forces' atrocities on Afghan soil. People here say the U.S. should be held accountable for crimes it has committed in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are making gains in southern and eastern Ukraine and have retaken dozens of villages from Russia. Zelensky says some of the territory is taken back in the regions of Kherson, Luhansk, and Donetsk. Russia has not yet confirmed the new advances by Ukraine, but latest maps revealed by Moscow show Russian troops had left many areas in Kherson and northeastern Kharkiv region. The new announcement by Zelensky comes only days after Moscow officially declared incorporation of the Kherson into the Russian Federation. Donetsk also joined Russia. People in those regions voted overwhelmingly in referendum to join the Russian Federation. Ukraine and its Western allies, including the EU and the US, have called the referendum, quote, illegal and a sham. The World Bank says Ukraine's economy is expected to shrink 35% this year due to various crises resulting from the ongoing war. An economic update for Europe and Central Asia. The bank said damage to agriculture and reduced labor supply are major causes for Ukraine's economic woes. The world body added that reconstruction of Ukraine will require at least $349 billion, or more than 1.5 times the size of its pre-war economy. The World Bank also said the ongoing war dampens prospects of a post-pandemic recovery for emerging and developing economies in the region as well. The Kremlin dismisses a UK media report that Russia was planning a nuclear test on Ukraine's border, calling the West's nuclear rhetoric.
You know, Western media, Western politicians and heads of states are now practicing a lot in spreading a nuclear rhetoric. We do not want to take part in it.
Peskov's remarks come a day after the Times newspaper reported that Russia was preparing to demonstrate its willingness to use nuclear weapons in its conflict with Ukraine. According to the report, NATO had warned its members over a possible nuclear test by Russia on its border with Ukraine. The British Daily also claimed that a train operated by the Russian Defense Ministry's nuclear division was destined for Ukraine. Meanwhile, the German foreign minister said on Tuesday that Russia's threat to resort to nuclear weapons must be taken seriously. Annalena Baerbock accused Moscow of trying to blackmail Western countries with what she called irresponsible threats. The British Prime Minister pledges to press ahead with her unpopular economic plan despite criticisms and a growing division within her cabinet. Liz Truss says she is determined to carry on with the growth package, suggesting that she could limit increases in benefit payments to less than soaring inflation. The plan has triggered a new row in the Conservative Party. Penny Mordaunt, who is in Truss's cupboard of senior ministers, has criticised the scheme. But of Home Secretary Suella Braverman has accused the party critics of seeking to stage a coup against Truss. Britain's new premier is seeking ways to fund her mini-budget that after she and her finance minister were forced to scrap their plan to cut income tax for the richest on Monday. The scheme had been met with the uproar from Tory critics and deep disapproval in opinion polls. It had also destabilized financial markets. The United States has conducted separate drills with Japan and South Korea amid escalating tensions with North Korea. During the military exercise with Japan, U.S. F-35 warplanes flew with Japanese F-15 and F-2 fighter jets. Separately, U.S. and South Korean warplanes conducted bombing drills in the Yellow Sea. Seoul said F-15 fighter jets, together with American warplanes, dropped a pair of guided bombs on a target off the country's west coast. The two countries also held a missile drill. They fired a barrage of ground-to-ground missiles into the Sea of Japan. Two short-range ballistic missiles were also fired into the water. The drills came after North Korea test-fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile over Japan. That was the first time a North Korean projectile had passed through Japan's airspace since 2017. South Korea has warned of a decisive response.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The United Kingdom government, which supported the establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel decades ago, is now moving further toward the Zionist regime and its sinister goals. There are reports that new British Prime Minister Liz Truss has already promised Zionist regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid that she will review whether to move the UK's embassy to Al-Quds. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, during her campaign for the leadership of the British Conservative Party, Liz Truss told the Conservative Friends of Israel, CFI, that if elected, she would consider relocating the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. At a subsequent meeting at the UN, Prime Minister Truss repeated the promise of a review to her friend Yair Lapid, the interim Zionist regime prime minister. The status of Al-Quds is the thorniest issue, one of the most bitter, prolonged and intractable international conflicts of modern times. East Al-Quds, along with the rest of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, were captured by the fabricated regime of Israel in June 1967 war and have ever since been viewed by the international community as occupied territory. The Zionist regime officials were naturally delighted that Truss floated the idea of moving the embassy to Al-Quds and thereby recognizing the Zionist regime's sovereignty over the city as one of her first foreign policy moves as prime minister. Palestinian leaders have warned that moving the embassy would undermine the two-state solution and destroy their relations with Britain. Hossam Zulmot, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK, said it was extremely unfortunate that Truss used her first appearance at the UN as prime minister to commit to potentially breaking international law. Middle East Eye added, it is difficult to think of a foreign policy issue that is less indeed of a review than the location of the British embassy in the occupied Palestinian territories. Moving the embassy to Al-Quds would violate a raft of UN resolutions and amount to an abrupt reversal of British policy since 1967. This policy, part of a broad international consensus, has held that all embassies should stay in Tel Aviv until a comprehensive peace agreement is reached, with Al-Quds as the shared capital of the two states. During her tenure as Foreign Secretary, Truss made no attempts to relocate the embassy. One can only speculate that she instigated a review for reasons of political expediency. To ingratiate herself with the Zionist regime and its supporters in Britain, and more specifically with CFI, whose membership includes most of the cabinet and around 80% of Tory backbenchers. One Israeli newspaper recently described Truss as potentially the most pro-Israel British prime minister ever. This was no doubt intended as praise, but it ignores Britain's historic responsibility for creating the problem in the first place. It all began with the Balfour Declaration of 1917 in support of a national home for the Jewish people in the land of Palestine, although the Jews were only 10% of the country's population at that time. The commitment that this would not be at expense of non-Jewish communities was completely ignored by successive British governments. The declaration thus enabled a systematic Zionist colonial takeover of Palestine, a process that is still ongoing. U.S. President Donald Trump was first world leader to break the long-standing agreement of the international community not to base embassies in Al-Quds until a two-state solution to the conflict is reached. His decision to move the American embassy to Al-Quds in 2018 was met with outrage across the world and provoked widespread international condemnation. It also led to a flare-up of violence in which dozens of Palestinians were martyred by the Zionist regime forces. Theresa May, the British Prime Minister at the time, criticized the move. Trump's much-vaunted deal of the century was a crude attempt to redefine the two-state solution as Greater Israel, as they baselessly claim, including about a third of the West Bank and the whole of Al-Quds, and a fragmented Palestinian state surrounded by Zionist regime settlements and military bases. It was promptly and contemptuously rejected by Palestinians. Despite Trump's best efforts, only three states have followed his example of moving their embassies to Al-Quds, including Kosovo, Guatemala, and Honduras. All other 82 countries with diplomatic missions in the occupied Palestinian territories opted to keep their embassies in Tel Aviv. Some of these countries, including Britain, also have a consulate general in East Al-Quds, which serves as a channel of communication with the PA in Ramallah. In her singularly pro-Israel stance and apparent indifference to Palestinian rights, Truss belongs to the mainstream of her party. All three prime ministers under whom she served have been staunch supporters of the fabricated regime of Israel. David Cameron described himself as a passionate friend of Israel and insisted that nothing could break that friendship. Theresa May was probably the most pro-Zionist leader in Europe during her premiership. In an address to CFI in 2016, she described the fabricated regime of Israel as a remarkable country, a thriving democracy, a beacon of tolerance, as she claimed baselessly. She furiously rejected a public petition, of which it was one of the signatories to issue an official apology for Balfour Declaration. Boris Johnson carried the Israel First conservative policy step further by placing the Zionist regime above international law. He resisted attempts to call it to account for its illegal actions and war crimes. In 2021, he announced that he opposed an international criminal court investigation into war crimes in the occupied territories, noting in a letter to CFI that while his government respected the independence of the court, it opposed this particular inquiry. Like Johnson, Truss is a passionate proponent of post-Brexit global Britain. Breaking international law, however, will do nothing to promote this brand, nor will it help to get a trade agreement with the US, which was touted as one of the major benefits of an independent foreign policy. Following Trump's example by moving the British embassy to Al-Quds would not go down well in the White House. Although Biden has not reversed the move of the American embassy, he has undertaken a series of measures to limit the damage done by his predecessor, and he has reverted to working with allies through the UN. To move the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds would be morally indefensible, legally questionable, and politically damaging. It would be one of the most savage British blows to Palestinian statehood since the Balfour Declaration. It would also encourage the Zionist regime to continue to act with impunity, reinforcing the arrogance of power. The fabricated regime of Israel and its supporters would surely welcome the move, despite the damage to Britain's standing in the world. Rather than review the location of its embassy, the British regime should reassess its relationship with the Zionist regime in light of present-day realities. In the last 2 years, reports by three major human rights organizations have concluded that the fabricated regime of Israel has become an apartheid regime. These reports carefully document the Zionist regime's ongoing ethnic cleansing, land confiscations, house demolitions, persecution of human rights defenders, detention of minors, and tolerance of settler violence. The sad truth is that since 1967, the fabricated regime of Israel has become addicted to occupation. A true friend does not indulge an addiction, but tries to win the addict from it.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your queries regarding the upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for accepting the invitation. Well, brother, we talked about different forms of dangers that screens bring with them. That was worldview, that was the danger of role models that are being portrayed, that are being represented to us. There was danger of desensitization. We get normal towards things that are not normal, actually. And there was a sense of wasting time, spending so much time achieving nothing. What are the other dangers these screens bring for us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So I'd like to mention one more danger and one more point of concern. Obviously, the list is not exhaustive. We can bring other points as well, but I think five is a good number to end. This fifth one, we've talked about it before a bit as well. I want to kind of bring it separately because it's so important.
All right.
And this is a damaged self-image. So one of the things that you find occurs whilst we are consuming what's coming on the screen is that it damages the image that we have of ourselves.
Okay.
So every human being has an image of themselves, of how they see themselves and how they want to see themselves as well.
Yeah.
So you have awareness of how you look, how your physical body is.
Yeah.
And how your moral state is, etc. And you also have something you aspire towards. I wish I was like this. I wish I had
different kind of ability.
Yes.
This particular
so in
kind.
Terms of our yeah. knowledge, in terms of our akhlaq, in terms of our physical body, in terms of different things about us, we have an image of us.
Yeah.
And we have an understanding of this image and where we want to take this. This image is destroyed by the screen. How? You find that I'll give different examples, but the main one is to do with body image. So you find that research has suggested, for instance, that 50% of adverts use body image for product appeal.
Yeah.
And so what happens is that women are faced with an idea of a body image that doesn't match theirs.
Yeah.
So you find that there is a body image that is counted as a perfect human body, a perfect physical beauty. And this body is something that is aspired towards because it's counted as beautiful, it's counted as what is amazing out there. At the same time, you find that research suggests that there's only 1% of chance that you can be as thin as a supermodel.
Yeah.
This is very interesting. And so as a conclusion, you find that many, many young teenage girls go through depression, go through crazy, being very harsh upon themselves through different diets, whatnot. Why? Because their self-image doesn't match the image that they have or what they want to achieve, basically. They find themselves not matching that image that they have of the true, amazing supermodel that they've seen. And this happens through adverts and through generally watching whatever comes on TV.
So we can say this is basically they have a lack of self-esteem as well. That's why they are concerning on body image. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we are talking about the dangers of animation, screens, and video games, and what can parents do about that. Well, Brother, you talked about body image. There's another danger. That's the destruction of self-image by just manifesting us the different forms of body image for the product appeal, which actually does not exist in real life. And I have personally seen, a couple of females who underwent knife, who did disastrous things with their bodies, and they still do not have that body image. They spent the money. They could have at least brought a flat with that money, but they spent it on their body to get that perfect body image. And not only they did not get that, in addition, they also, I was listening to this female who said that she cannot bear children for some 5 years at least, and many other things that were horrible to listen. So you're saying all this comes with the destruction of self-image that is brought by screens.
That's correct. You talked about self-esteem. Self-esteem is such an important concept. Where do we get our self-esteem from is when we understand that value that we have of ourselves, the true human perfection. This true human perfection is taught to us by the Quran, is taught to us by the Ahlul Bayt, is taught to us by our intellect of what we can really achieve. But you find that animations today, the movies out there, the video games out there, they teach us the wrong values for the human being on one side, and on the other side, they teach us something that is not achievable for us. Us as the general population, the 99.99%, can't achieve that which is seen on the screen.
Yeah.
Right? And so that is a self-esteem destruction, right? It destroys our understanding of ourselves, of our self-worth, etc. And this brings about all these mental issues and mental health issues and other things. So we need to be very careful of this. You find that another example in the same topic. So you know these games where you have to create an avatar of yourself,
right?
And you build it according to how you see yourself.
Yeah.
Or these games that are very famous between girls as well, young girls, right? Where they've got a face, for example, a whole body of a girl that they have to dress, that they have to put makeup on, that they have to beautify in different ways. And you can do so many different things out there.
All right.
And all of this is centered around this idea that, one, physical beauty is perfection. And secondly, that which comes out of it is something that's impossible for you to in real life achieve.
Yeah.
Right? So it destroys the image that you have of yourself as what is real, true human perfection you need to achieve. And this is detrimental for young girls because in terms of their hijab, in terms of their modesty, in terms of their what they want to achieve in life, all is being they're being fed is that what you want to achieve in life is this thin body that you want to get, this kind of hair, this kind of makeup. And then when you see these young girls, when they go towards that in their real life, we kind of wonder what happened, what went wrong.
Yeah.
What went wrong exactly is these avatars that they're building throughout their lives on the
apps.
Virtual world.
Yeah.
Now they're on the real world. They obviously don't want to build this for themselves, and just not happening. So this is something that we need to be aware of and
concerned
about.
Yeah. Well, brother, we'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam said, "A child's right is to be kind to him when educating him, forgiving him, covering his mistakes, acting moderately towards him, and helping him."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we are talking about the dangers of screen. Brother, you talked about avatar as well. Like, there are girls who actually play with these different avatars, and then they are not very confident about themselves. They have a destruction of self-image. What else?
Look at, to give another example in this, is family life, right? You find that very often the family life is portrayed in a particular way in movies and animations. On one side, you have, it always ends in a very beautiful, romantic, beautiful relationship, basically. Portrayed in such a way that is, again, it doesn't show the reality, right? Many people enter marriage with that idea of how they're going to feel that, I don't know, relationship with their husband or their wives.
Yeah.
And in reality,
That does not happen.
It doesn't happen, right? Or it requires a lot of effort to make it happen, which in the movies, it didn't show us any effort. It just happened, right?
Yeah.
But in real life, it requires effort for that true love, that true bonding to happen. It requires a lot of effort. And obviously, it comes with challenges. It comes with difficulties. It comes with misunderstandings. It comes with arguments. It always happens in real life.
Yeah.
And you find that many people then kind of give up. It goes to divorces. It goes to, it didn't match my expectations.
Or at least they think that I have married the wrong person.
Exactly. The issue was what? Was the image that we built of how I want to be was created from a world that was virtual world. That was a completely wrong world. What you can achieve in the virtual world doesn't match what you can in the real life.
Yeah.
And so this kind of break between these two leads us to be to kind of really fail in our true life.
And do you think that also creates a destruction of relationships?
Definitely.
As well?
I mean, there's definitely a direct correlation between relationships being very weak today and what we are fed with from different aspects of the social media or the cinema or video games, etc.
Yeah, I mean, whatever we are being taught from screen, it can affect our relationship with our parents as well, with our children, with our partners, especially because, as you said, what is being taught, the fantasy kind of things, people keep imagining that this is the reality, but then when they confront the reality, they cannot bear it actually. And this is because of the screens. This is another danger of screens. We talked about the destruction of self-image that is being caused by the screens. And we talked about many other dangers. Well, maybe there are more dangers, or maybe there's more on this topic. And there's also what could be done. We'll talk about that in another session, inshallah. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems, Allah leads. stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, by the laws of Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The deadly Israeli wars on Gaza are made possible not only by Western weapons and political support, but through an endless stream of media misinformation and misrepresentation, says Ramzi Barut, journalist, in an article published under the heading Deliberate Misrepresentation. Western media bias makes Zionist regime war on Palestinians possible. Here's more. While U.S. and Western mainstream and corporate media remain biased in favor of the Zionist regime, they often behave as if they are a third neutral party. This is simply not the case. Take the New York Times coverage of the Zionist regime's latest war on Gaza as an example. Its article on August 6 is Israel-Gaza fighting flares for a second day. It's a typical mainstream Western reporting on the Zionist regime and Palestine, but with a distinct NYT flavor. For the uninformed reader, the article succeeds in finding a balanced language between two equal sides. This misleading moral equivalence is one of the biggest intellectual blind spots for Western journalists. If they do not outwardly champion the Zionist regime's discourse on security and right to defend itself, they create false parallels between Palestinians and Israelis as if a military occupier and an occupied nation have comparable rights and responsibilities. For New York Times and all mainstream Western media, there is no question regarding who the good guys and the bad guys are in that bloody fight. Palestinians, in their view, always have been the West bad guys. Per the logic of their media coverage, the Zionist regime does not launch unprovoked wars on Palestinians and is not an unrepentant military occupier or a racist apartheid regime. This language can only be used by marginal, radical, and leftist media, never the mainstream. The brief introduction of the NYT article spoke about the rising death toll, but did not initially mention that 20 killed Palestinians include children, emphasizing instead that Israeli regime attacks have killed a leader. When the 6 children killed by the Zionist regime are revealed in the second paragraph, the article immediately and without starting a new sentence clarifies that Israel said some civilian deaths were the result of militants stashing weapons in residential areas and that others were killed by misfired Palestinian rockets. On August 16th, the Zionist regime military finally admitted that it was behind the strikes that killed the 5 young Palestinian boys of Jabalia. Whether the invitee reported on that or not matters little. The damage has been done, and that was the Zionist regime's plan from the start. The title of the BBC story of August 16th, Gaza's Children Are Used to the Death and Bombing, does not immediately name those responsible for the death and bombing. Even the Zionist regime military spokesman, as we will discover later, would agree to such a statement, though they will always lay the blame squarely on the Palestinians. When the story finally reveals that a little girl, Layan, was killed in an Israeli regime strike, the language was carefully crafted to lessen the blame on her, Israeli regime murderers. The girl, we are told, was on her way to the beach with her family when their tuk-tuk passed by a military camp run by the group Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which at the exact moment was targeted by Israeli fire. The author says nothing of how she reached the conclusion that the family was not the target. One can easily glean from the story that the Zionist regime intention was not to kill Layan, and logically, none of the 17 other children murdered during the 3-day war on Gaza. Besides, the Zionist regime has, according to the BBC, tried to save the little girl. Alas, a week of treatment and an Israeli hospital couldn't save her life. Though the Zionist regime politicians have spoken blatantly about killing Palestinian children, and in the case of former Israeli regime so-called Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, the Palestinian mothers who give birth to little snakes, the BBC report and other reports on the latest war have failed to mention this. Instead, it quoted Israeli regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid, who reportedly said that the death of innocent civilians, especially children, is heartbreaking. Incidentally, Lapid ordered the latest war on Gaza, which killed a total of 49 Palestinians. Even a human interest story about a murdered Palestinian child somehow avoided the language that could fault the fabricated regime of Israel for the gruesome killing of a little girl. Furthermore, the BBC also labored to present the Zionist regime in a positive light, resorting to quote the occupation army's statement that it was devastated by Layan's death and that of any civilians. The New York Times and BBC have been selected here not because they are the worst examples of Western media bias, but because they are often cited as liberal, if not progressive media. The reporting, however, represents an ongoing crisis in Western journalism, especially relating to Palestine. Books have been written about this subject. Civil society organizations were formed to hold Western media accountable, and numerous editorial board meetings were organized to put some pressure on Western editors to no avail. Desperate by the unchanging pro-Israel narratives in Western media, some pro-Palestine human rights advocates often argue that there are greater margins within Israeli regime's own mainstream media than in the U.S. For example, this too is inaccurate. The misnomer of the supposedly more balanced Israeli regime media is a direct outcome of the failure to influence Western media coverage on Palestine and the Zionist regime. The erroneous notion is often buoyed by the fact that an Israeli newspaper like Haaretz gives marginal spaces to critical voices like those of Israeli journalist Gideon Levy and Amira Haas. Israeli regime propaganda, one of the most sophisticated in the world, however, can hardly be balanced by occasional columns written by a few dissenting journalists. Additionally, Haaretz is often cited as an example of relatively fair journalism simply because the alternatives, including the Times of Israel, the Jerusalem Post, and other right-wing Israeli media, are exemplary in their callousness, biased language, and misconstruing of facts. The pro-Israel prejudices in Western media often spill over to Palestine sympathetic media throughout the West Asia region and the rest of the world, especially those reporting on the news in English and French. Since many newspapers and online platforms utilize Western news agencies, they often inadvertently adopt the same language used in Western news sources, thus depicting Palestinian resistors or fighters as militants, the Israeli regime occupation army as Israeli forces, and Israeli war on Gaza as flare-ups of violence. In its totality, this language misinterprets the Palestinian struggle for freedom as random acts of violence within a protracted conflict where innocent civilians like Layan are caught in the crossfire. The deadly Zionist regime wars on Gaza are made possible not only by Western weapons and political support, but through an endless stream of media misinformation and misrepresentation. Though the fabricated regime of Israel has killed thousands of Palestinian civilians in recent years, Western media remains as committed to defending the Zionist regime as if nothing has changed.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.